said, the next case on the docket this morning is Arnold Raphael Easton versus Commonwealth. Morning, Mr. Jones. How are you?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm well, thank you. Vaughn Jones on behalf of Mr. Easton.
Would you like to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I'd ask for 5 minutes, please.
All right. If you have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the first, may it please the court, the first assignment of error that I'd like to start with is whether or not the trial court erred by allowing the appellant to present a physical demonstration, as the court has read from my brief.
And talk about the teeth.
That's it, Judge. The display of his teeth.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes,
was
sir?
That raised as just an objection or as a constitutional objection at trial?
It is the case that, as the appellee states, the issue about it being a constitutional objection was not raised in front of the
okay,
front of the court.
Okay, that being said, then we can get to harmless error analysis, correct?
We can, sir.
What is your view as to the evidence with respect to your client's guilt? What difference would it make on this evidence if the teeth were displayed or not?
Judge, I think it would have made a tremendous difference, and I understand the position of the appellee in this situation to imply that it wouldn't because of the DNA evidence, because of the other evidence that was mentioned at trial. But there's two things I'd like to bring the court's attention to there. First of all, in this case, there are two separate witnesses that are two separate assaults. And not only was it an issue that it was Mr. Easton...
Are you talking about assault and an abduction?
Well, I'm talking about two attacks of two different victims, two female victims.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only was it an issue of whether or not one, he committed both crimes, but whether or not the same person committed both crimes. And not only was there an issue with the identification for both of the two alleged victims, but there was an addition, there's the issue of whether or not there were disparate identifications. Did one person commit the crime, the other did not? So had there been straight teeth on one person but not on the other, that would have been an important issue.
What now, about the DNA and fingerprints?
That there is relevance of DNA and fingerprints being present in both instances, and I do concede that. Nonetheless, to take from a defendant the ability to say that the alleged victim of a crime of this incredibly horrible and graphic nature, but to take from the defendant the ability to say that this particular victim here cannot or has misidentified my client or has identified him differently from the other victim was huge.
What about the fingerprints and DNA? They were both tied to your client, were they not?
There was fingerprints in one instance tied to my client, DNA, and in another instance tied to him, yes, sir. And I can see that is the case.
Was the abduction, the objection to the abduction, on the grounds of incidental, was that raised at trial?
I believe that was raised at trial, Judge, that it was that the abduction was in my motion to strike. It was raised that it was incidental to the crime of the... of the carjacking that was for that particular victim, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
And I do understand I do understand some impetus from the court or from the appellee to say that there may have been harmless error in a case where I do concede that there was a significant number of different types of information pointing towards Mr. Easton, the appellant, as the potential assailant in this instance. But I do think that this is a very important case, perhaps a first impression even in the Commonwealth, of whether or not this type of information might have been testimonial. And keep in mind, the trial court found very directly, that this was evidence that was testimonial in nature when it was absolutely objected to by the appellant, Mr. Easton, objecting that it was testimonial. The reason this is very crucial...
You're talking about...
The teeth evidence would have been testimonial. Yes, sir. And again, it strikes a fundamental unfairness, Your Honors, as I see it, to say to a person that he can be compelled to be in a lineup, he can be compelled to give a voice exemplar, he can be compelled to give fingerprint or DNA evidence, and none of those things are held to be testimonial because we recognize that testimonial evidence is evidence where someone is giving some opinion or observation about someone. So to say to that same defendant, you can be compelled to give DNA, as existed in this case, or participate in a photo lineup, as happened in this case, but you cannot present similar evidence that would go to your
innocence. Getting back to Judge Haley's question regarding harmless error, and since we're looking at this from a non-constitutional perspective because of the circumstances of trial, how can we say that what has been presented would suggest that the defendant... But for the failure, let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree with you that the failure to allow the defendant to do this demonstration was error. How can we say with reasonable certainty that but for this, the defendant would not have been found guilty?
Judge, It is the case that when doing a harmless error analysis, we're not going to have the opportunity to go in and hear what the fact finders had based their opinion upon. When it's a jury trial, I concede that. But in this case, and I do concede that there are a number of other types of evidence that were presented that the jury could have put, the fact finder could have made their decision based upon, I do think that this is not harmless error. I do think that this error precipitated the defense that was presented. And the reason I do, Judge, is quite candidly part of the argument that was made by the appellee. The appellee indicates in its brief that the trial attorney, the defense attorney, did not make the appearance of the defendant part of his closing argument. Well, there's very clear reason why. As a defense,
he was precluded from doing
that. That's exactly it.
I'm not so much concerned about that.
No, and that's exactly it. That's why I would say that it's not harmless error, Judge, because, Your Honor, it was absolutely a case that boiled down to identification.
When I look at harmless error, though, I'm not speaking for the entire court, but when I look at harmless error, I look at it from a qualitative analysis. In other words, what is the quality of this evidence that has been precluded? And the quality of this evidence was, okay, should have been allowed, theoretically, to do this, or to conduct this demonstration. But when we look at the quality of the evidence and balance it against everything else that the government came forward with, this balance does not suggest that we have any problem with the fundamental fairness of the trial. I'm not saying that this is necessarily the case, but the defendant was not able to do his demonstration, but there were 37 witnesses who saw him do this. Would it be harmless error for him not to be able to do the demonstration? Sure. Okay, because we got 37 witnesses who come in, and the trial court, the fact finder, found them to be believable. But in this case, instead of having the 37 witnesses, we have this forensic evidence that is recognized as provides some level of certainty regarding circumstances, and we're balancing it against the defendant's preclusion from presenting this demonstration evidence. And so do we have any problem with the adjudication? Does it seem fair when we look at all the quality of the evidence presented? And I think that's a hurdle that you need to overcome.
Judge, I would differentiate this case from the one where there's 37 witnesses.
Yes.
I do concede that you could compare that math to the math that might present itself in a DNA case, which is more than 1 in 37. I'd concede that. But that is still one form of evidence. And in this case, going back to the specific information about the alleged first assailant, the lady who was who was showing off the house for real estate purposes, that witness was the one who described Mr. Eason as a person having, as I put it in my brief, that person having straight teeth. His DNA or his forensic information being there would not have been unusual and could have been explained, as the evidence suggested, at trial, because he did have a romantic relationship with the next-door neighbor and had previously been inside the house. It would have been a more efficient argument, and it would have been an argument that counsel could have made to say that he had been in the house for reasonable and legal reasons, because it was a show house, for lack of a better term, and he could have explained that he had been there on those occasions, but he was not the assailant because the assailant had different appearing teeth. And I do concede that that might sound like an attenuated argument, but again, we're looking at beyond a reasonable doubt, and you would hope that a defendant would have the ability to make that argument, would have the ability to argue, yes, my DNA is here, here's a legal explanation for why it's there, but allow me now to differentiate myself from the person who actually committed the attack, because the fingerprint evidence and the blood evidence that were there did not necessarily indicate that the defendant was there at the time of the attack. It just showed that he'd been there previously.
So tell me the information in the record that discounts the forensic evidence that was presented. What other justifications that are in the record could provide suggestions of why the forensic evidence is there?
The defendant did have testify at trial, and I apologize for not being able to cite to the specific page of the transcript and the record, Judge, but I know that presented at trial was the testimony of a woman who was his wife at the time of trial, girlfriend at the time of the incident, who lived next door to where the show house was. And she testified that she and the defendant had gone through the house to see it on a number of occasions. She said that they'd been there on a couple of occasions. So that could have, would have been an argument.
How does that get his DNA, your client's DNA, on the cell phone case?
The cell phone case is a more difficult scenario to explain, Your Honor. I do concede that. I mean, in the cell phone case, the one that was taken from that victim, and found at a later at a different location. That's a more difficult situation to explain. You know, I don't know that and the court may have a completely different opinion about me than I do on this, and I would concede to your opinion. But I don't know if the harmless error analysis necessarily means that I have to present that there might not have been any evidence contrary to my position. I mean, I have to say that it's inconsequential. I don't think the cell phone case in and of itself could have convicted Mr. Eason. I would not concede that. I understand that the inability for the witnesses to identify Mr. Eason was not the only position put forward by the Commonwealth, but I do think it's crucial to say that a victim's inability to identify him, or, as I said earlier, describing him differently than the other victim did, would have been crucial, because it certainly would have been a defense position that the defendant may not have been the person who committed both of these crimes. Your Honor, I would like to address the attempted murder. I will concede that that is not as strong of a prong as my first argument. I do want to base the court to base the majority of its focus on the first issue.
Whoever did it said you're going to be dead, didn't
it? I'm sorry, sir?
Whoever did it said you're going to be dead.
He did, Judge, and I think that's something that's important, but I think as practitioners we would have to concede that I apologize to the law enforcement here, but if I were to say, Judge, if you rule against me, I'm going to kill you. Now, if I walk towards you, I don't know that that makes me guilty of attempted murder. If I throw my
pills in her mouth and tried to push her to swallow them, she very shrewdly hit them with her tongue and then spit them out and put them under her body, right? And then on his way out, he's, don't worry, you're going to be dead in a few minutes.
My response to that, Judge, is what if those pills were Tic Tacs? What if they were aspirin? What if there was never
any... just messing with her head. But don't we... I mean, we're looking at the totality of the evidence here, not what various things that might be.
And the evidence suggested that they weren't Tic Tacs, that they were some sort of hallucinogens or something.
Yes, sir, but the evidence also suggested that the amount of pills he had were nowhere near a dosage that could potentially have killed her. So the inference there is... He did place a bag over this woman's head. Yes, he did the assailant did place some type of drug into her mouth and said those things, but it's certainly a more reasonable conclusion to say that because there was not a lethal amount given, nor was there any evidence that they could have ever been lethal, like the Tic Tacs, those were subterfuges in order to get away with the assault. And
but that argument is difficult because, I'm not talking about your circumstance here, but if a person has designed to kill someone and they get rat poison and they put it in the person's Gatorade and they don't put enough in there to actually kill the person, and an expert comes in and says, oh, that amount of rat poison wouldn't have killed anybody, but it was the intention of the individual when he put the rat poison in there to actually accomplish that objective, he can still be prosecuted for that attempted murder.
Without a doubt, Judge, and I think then you would have to look at what are the other circumstances. Now, if that person put the rat poison in the Gatorade but then never provided it to them, or he put it in the person's vicinity but then took it back before they could do it, I don't know that that would be an attempt to kill somebody. I think that would be an... I don't know that I would agree that would be an attempt.
But if you believe the...
You're going into your bubble time.
And I'll ask this question real quick. But if you believe the Commonwealth's theory of the case is that all of the underlying actions, the assaults at life, all lead to this idea that after I commit this assault, Cummins case, I'm going to make sure that there are no witnesses, so I'm going to kill you by giving you this, what I believe to be a lethal amount of drugs. If you believe the Cummins theory of the case.
Very quickly, in light of my time, I would concede the point that Your Honor, Judge Beals made about the fact that he did say you're going to be dead anyway. It hurts what I'm about to say, but nonetheless, he did walk away from that situation and seemingly leave her there without the intent to finish her off, for lack of a better way of putting it, and knowing that he had done actions that would not have actually terminated her.
Yes,
thank you.
Good morning.
Hey, please the court, Christian Handel for the Commonwealth.
Mr. Shanabout, to make things a little simpler for at least me, do you believe that it was error for the trial court to not allow, in light of the case law that's out there, to allow the defendant to conduct this demonstration?
I don't believe that it was error, but I believe the court reached the right result for the wrong reason, essentially.
Okay.
And the reason that the result was correct is because in order for evidence to be admissible and demonstrative evidence to be admissible, it has to be material to some fact that was at issue.
No, the materiality would be that... The Commonwealth's relying on eyewitness testimony, and the eyewitness have, according to the defendant's theory of the case, failed to present a significant circumstance that would have supplemented that eyewitness testimony, and that is the unusual affectation or the unusual appearance of the defendant.
I understand the opposing counsel's position on that, Your Honor. I would submit that would be true if the first victim's identification of the defendant as a perpetrator was at all a part of the Commonwealth's case. Here, the extent to which she identified him, she picked him and another person out of a lineup of six people and said maybe it was one of these two people. At trial, that victim did not identify the defendant as the perpetrator. In opening arguments, the prosecutor never mentioned either witness's identification because I think the prosecutor believed at that time that neither of the witnesses was going to identify the defendant. This case was primarily a circumstantial evidence case based on very strong forensic circumstantial evidence, which he cannot.
So the trial matter, there was never any eyewitness testimony. That's the person who did that.
One of the two victims did testify to that.
The carjacking
victim, but that victim never said anything or was asked anything about the defendant's teeth. So what the defense's theory of this demonstration is that he should have been able to do this demonstration to impeach the first victim's testimony, the first victim who never made a conclusive identification of the defendant, only narrowed it down to two out of six in the photo lineup. And then, again, harmless error may be the best and narrowest grounds for determining this issue in this case. However, I think on the merits, because in order for evidence to be admissible, it has to be material to some fact at issue. The first victim's identification of the defendant was never really at issue in this case, and above and beyond that, her memory of what the defendant or what the perpetrator's teeth looked like was certainly not at issue in this case.
Well, as you know, the materiality has always been defined as what weight we're going to give something. In other words, what is the significance of it? And if the Commonwealth is relying on, at least in one of these cases, identification as part of its case, why isn't the defendant entitled to come back at that identification and question the reliability or question the significance of that identification?
If the defendant's attempt to question the significance or reliability had anything to do with what the witness actually testified, then sure, he'd be permitted to. If she had...
if Linda Jones had said that, it'd be different.
Correct.
She identified him in court.
She's the only witness, victim who identified him in court. So if she had said, yes, he had perfect straight white teeth, then perhaps he should have been allowed, and I would have a hard time arguing on the merits. I would still argue harmless. However, she didn't say anything about his teeth. The only witness who did was the first witness. And as I point out in my brief, and I don't say this lightly, and counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, but as it appears to me, his entire argument is premised on what is a plain misstatement of the record and a plain misstatement of the first victim's testimony.
And that testimony certainly isn't clear about Pete.
At the very best, it's equivocal.
At the very best, it's absolutely...
Yes, Your Honor. And at page 2 of Eason's opening brief, he purportedly quotes the first victim's testimony and says...
And he doesn't quote all of it, does he?
Well, I don't think he quotes any of it on page 2. He says that her she claimed that the perpetrator had, quote, normal, .. white, end quote, teeth. That quote doesn't appear anywhere in the record as far as I can tell, and counsel can correct me if I'm wrong. Counsel on cross used the word normal, and then she, at some point in giving an equivocal response and saying, I don't really remember, she says something, maybe whites, maybe, I'm not sure. But that quote certainly doesn't appear in the record. And on page 5 of opposing counsel's brief...
What was quoted in the brief was... a question from counsel.
Correct.
Not
that's
testimony of the defendant.
Of the victim. Correct, Your Honor. On page 5 of the brief, the quote is that Ms. Staten asserted that the attacker had, quote, regular white teeth, not gold. If you turn to page 343 of the appendix, the question that was posed to the victim on page 343 was, question, he had regular white teeth, not gold teeth or anything like that? Answer, no, I don't remember. I mean, I didn't focus on his teeth. So opposing counsel attempted to put words in the victim's mouth on cross-examination. The victim rejected that attempt and said, no, I don't remember the perpetrator's teeth. I don't remember. I didn't focus on that. And now on appeal, he's trying to put those words back in her mouth in order to create a reversible issue.
So the quote in the appellant's brief is not accurate.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. And if I'm missing something somewhere else in the record, I'm happy to be corrected, but the quote is not accurate. Thank you, Your Honor. And for that reason, Your Honor, there is no merit to the argument that there's reversible error here. One, because there was no fact at issue that needed to be rebutted by this demonstration. Thus, the demonstration was not material. And thus, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in saying, I'm not going to allow that demonstration.
Assuming he did, the trial court.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your view on harmless error analysis? It's not constitutional raised here.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your view on that?
So the only argument is non-constitutional, so the standard enunciating Clay applies, and thus it's only a reversible error if it could have substantially influenced the jury. In this case, given the overwhelming evidence, it's just not possible that this error, if it were error, could have substantially influenced the jury. He's given no reasonable explanations for the forensic evidence against him, for his fingerprints inside of the stolen car, for his DNA mixed in blood with the victim's DNA on the victim's stolen cell phone case, which was located in between the first victim's house and the second victim's house, kind of discarded. And then for the victim's...
His girlfriend's next door to the...
The defendant was living next door to the first victim at the time.
Yeah.
Correct. So he had the opportunity. And then the victim's blood was found on a hat that matched a hat that had been discarded in between the two homes, that matched a hat that the ex-girlfriend testified she had purchased for the defendant. So that forensic evidence is overwhelming. There have been no explanations other than that certainly appears to be strong evidence against my client. So the demonstration of the teeth, in comparison, it pales in comparison to the overwhelming evidence of Mr. Eason's guilt in this case, in addition to the opportunity he had to commit the crime, as Your Honor has noted, in addition to the fact that after the crimes were committed, Mr. Eason drove to his ex-girlfriend's house, and while he was there, a police car pulled up three houses down, and the defendant ran inside and told his ex-girlfriend, if they come to our door, tell them I'm not here, tell them you haven't seen me. Right, and of course that is also evidence of his guilty mind at the time and affirmative evidence of his guilt. So overwhelming evidence.
From the Bible, the wicked flee when no man pursueth.
And at that point, no men were yet pursuing, but he thought that they were. And that led to his response in that case, in that instance. Turning to the intent to kill and the direct acts towards that killing, of course he placed a garbage bag over the victim's head and struggled to pull that bag tightly around her face for about 10 minutes as she struggled to breathe, as she her nose hit the floor and he knocked her down, and she was choking on her blood, struggling to breathe. She thought she was going to die. The only thing that saved her, she was able to poke holes in the bag and eventually rip a portion of the bag off of her head. That certainly is enough for the reasonable fact finder to conclude an intent to kill and direct acts towards killing. As to the pills, that's an additional and separate grounds to find that there is an intent to kill. Factual impossibility is not a defense to a crime, so it, irrespective of whether or not that amount of hallucinogens would have killed her, that's neither here nor there when it comes to proving an attempt. Otherwise, we couldn't convict someone for soliciting a minor if it turns out they were actually having a conversation with a law enforcement officer. Because the defense there would be, well, impossibility, that wasn't a minor, that was a law enforcement officer, but as courts have repeatedly held, factual impossibility is not a defense to a crime. The same applies here as to these pills. I will just clarify for the record, it was stated in an argument a moment ago that we know for a fact that amount would not have killed her. We don't actually know that for a fact. There was just no testimony either way as to whether or not that amount would have been lethal. So we're left really with the defendant's words on that point, which were, you will be dead in a few minutes. And you can certainly infer a defendant's intent based on his own words, based on his conduct and casually leaving the room after attempting to force those pills down her throat and thinking she'd swallow
them.
The pills were tested to determine what they were, and the conclusion was that they were hallucinogens. And I can't pronounce the word that they used in describing what they were, but we know that they were hallucinogens. We just don't know how many of those it would have taken to actually kill her. But again, factual impossibility is not a defense, so all that matters is that he intended to kill her. either with those pills or with the garbage bag or both, and the evidence was sufficient. On the other two assignments of error, the incidental detention argument was not preserved below. Counsel has argued that it was preserved in his motion to strike. I read that motion to strike very carefully. At some point, he mentions, you know, he argues that there just was no detention here, and thus the evidence was insufficient. But that's a very different argument from saying, well, there was detention, but it was incidental to the detention necessary to commit the robbery.
Counsel represented that he, you know, used the word incidental. In his motion to strike, I didn't see it either, so
I'd be interested in hearing if there is an appendix site that I could double check, but I didn't see it in the record. Even if it had been preserved, the victim was detained at the front door as she's trying to escape, yep. And then he later stole her purse back in the kitchen. She left the purse in the kitchen when she tried to escape. So at that time, he could have gone and taken the purse and taken the keys inside and walked away without ever detaining her. So on the merits, the argument also fails. And then finally, the final argument as to pecuniary benefit. Opposing counsel mentions the Crummer case, which is a case where the Supreme Court of Virginia says carjacking and taking a car is enough to constitute pecuniary benefit because it costs money to ride from one location to another if you're going to get public transportation. In this case, the defendant stole the victim's car so he could drive from one location to another to get away from the crime scene. That certainly costs money if you're going to hire a taxi or Uber. And the courts have held that it doesn't have to be money changing hands as long as there's some financial benefit. That was certainly the case here. And for all these reasons, unless the court has any additional questions on any of the assignments of error, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Any further questions for Mr.
Judge Haley cites Proverbs 28:1.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate you making that clear for the record.
Mr. Jones, you have your rebuttal time, and we ask you a lot of questions, so if you need a little more.
Thank you, Judge, Your Honors. I would want to go back to the issue about what words were said by defense counsel and compare them to what words were actually said by the witnesses. I do acknowledge...
The transcript speaks for itself.
It does, Judge, and I'd like to point to the transcript where the answer of the witness was, no, I didn't notice gold teeth. That was her answer, not my words. And then she later said, one question later, no, I meant it wasn't like protruding or missing. And so again, what I did say in my brief, I did say that she accepted the term, which did come from my question. And it did come from my question where I said regular white teeth, nor not gold teeth. That was my question. But one answer later, she said, no, I didn't notice gold teeth. That was the answer of the witness. So she very clearly, the witness herself, said that there were not gold teeth.
She said, I didn't notice there were gold teeth. If you have someone pulling the bag over your head and trying to strangle you, you're probably not going to focus too much on their teeth.
And she also said, I don't recall, didn't she?
She did say, I don't recall, and she says, I think, I guess, when she's maybe... And then it is an equivocal. I don't think that's an unfair characteristic of her statement. Nonetheless, I do feel that as defense counsel representing someone trying to give them effective assistance of counsel, I would have wanted to have had the opportunity to contradict even an equivocal comparison and description by a witness, a victim of a horrible crime, to something that would have been unequivocal, which would be the actual appearance of the defendant. And that would be the extent of my argument, as unless there's any other questions that the court might have about his ability to put forth the evidence as described as demonstrative, which I agree, or still assert is not testimonial in nature. As to the attempt, I think the court has heard my arguments. I would rest on my brief unless there are any other questions.
Questions for counsel?
I have none, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We will recounsel.